The Tom Woods Show, episode 2353.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey folks, believing that the end of the world might be a bad thing that we should try to avoid is not a Russian talking point. But if we are going to avoid World War III, it's important for Americans to understand what's been left out of the CIA's narrative about Russia and Ukraine. Coming to the rescue here is my brand new free ebook, Your Facebook Friends Are Wrong About Ukraine. Pick it up at wrongaboutukraine.com. Hey everybody, Tom Woods here. Very glad to be joined by Jared Casey, who is, of course, you have been retired from some time from University College Dublin teaching philosophy. Is that right? When did you retire?
I retired in 2016.
Oh, that is quite some time.
Indeed it is.
Okay. Is your time these days occupied by perhaps yet another book, or are you all done with that?
Oh, well, that's a really good question. I sometimes tell people I'm actually working on a new project, but I seem to spend most of my time avoiding it. I do have a sort of book in mind that I've been fooling around for 2 years doing bits and pieces of research, but I just can't seem to get the concentration together in the way I used to. So I don't know if it'll ever come to fruition. I just find actually talking about it means I do less with it. So I want to wait till it comes out, if it ever comes out.
Okay. Well, maybe at some point I'll probe deeper onto regarding what this is, because if it's something I'm really interested in, I'll figure out some way to corral you into doing it. But anyway, by the way, because that's one of the things I'm good at on this show. Every once in a while, I give people ideas for books they should write, but never anything I need to do. I don't need to do anything except interview people. But I am actually doing another book this year. I mentioned it a couple times, I think, on the podcast and mentioned a bunch of times in my email. I'll tell you about that later. But let's talk about our topic for today. The reason I thought to ask you about this has to do with our friend Gene Epstein.
Yes.
I don't know if did I mention that Gene Epstein had a hand in this?
I suspected so, because that's how the whole thing sort of started. I noticed we sometimes connect on Twitter, and I noticed he was doing a debate. So I thought, well, I've got something that you might find useful. And I sent him a copy of this old paper I had. And I think that's how it started, yeah.
Okay, though, that is in fact what happened, because we have lunch with him all the time when we're in New York. And one of the times we were there, my wife has this view that I kind of have, that even if I don't know the answer to some libertarian puzzle, I know Gene knows it. And so I can go about my life in the happy confidence that there is an answer somewhere, and it's probably in Gene Epstein's brain. Well, in particular, she has a particular concern about what is the fate of the poor in a libertarian society. And Gene gave us this just absolutely knock your socks off fantastic answer. I really feel like we should be recording these lunches, Professor Casey, you know, for the future. Record these lunches for posterity, because so many gems from Gene Epstein. Well, anyway, so he got your paper, as you say, that you gave to him, and then he forwarded it to us and said, here's a paper Jenna would like. He said, because it answers the very question you asked me about at lunch that time. So I thought, what the heck? I bet there must be people in the old Woods podcast audience who would have the same kind of question. And of course, it is, as you say in the paper, maybe one of the best known caricatures of libertarianism, or I would say in addition to that, the most common objection that for some reason our opponents think we have no answer to, that if they say this, we have to just go cower and hide. But this is the kind of thing like the roads that, of course, we've thought about. Why wouldn't we? And we do have answers to it. But the conventional wisdom, or even if this isn't what they really think in their heart of hearts, we believe, the way they like to portray us is as people who just don't care, and the policies we favor would make poverty worse and would grind people's noses in the dirt and all that. So I thought, you know what, I probably covered this at some point, but it was could have been thousands of episodes ago by now. I did have David Beto on, and you refer to him in your paper, but that was a really long time ago, talking about fraternal societies and friendly societies, stuff like that. So let's start with this whole thing, the way you organize it in the paper. And that begins with just a reminder of what we're talking about when we talk about libertarianism. We're talking about libertarianism. We're not talking about selfishness as a philosophy. We're not doing anything like that. We're just spelling out a particular principle that we intend to live our lives by. And so what is it?
Oh, it's the zero aggression principle, really, which amounts to saying you may not initiate or threaten to initiate aggression against another person or that other person's property. End of story.
Can I ask you, if you wouldn't mind, I had you want to talk about this. Why specifically you use the term zero aggression principle as opposed to non-aggression? I know that Gene has since adopted your usage. What's the reason for that?
Well, it's just that I discovered over the years of teaching that if you use a negative expression, comprehension drops. And apart from the rhetorical force of being in favor of something that's negative, isn't something that you really want to be. Okay. So it's partly cosmetic, but it's just also a zero aggression, which, if you like, removes the negativity from it. I mean, by the way, ZAP is a much cooler acronym than NAP.
Yeah, I do like ZAP, I have to admit. That is pretty good one. Okay, so that's what it boils down to. Now, there are a lot of libertarians, first of all, and there are a lot of people, but there are actually a lot of libertarians who will tell you that the, well, I'll use your term, zero aggression principle ought to be abandoned. It's unhelpful. It doesn't really contain anything, or it needs to be supplemented by various other principles in order to be coherent. Like you have to define property rights, whatever it is. But there are a lot of complaints about that principle. Do you think any of them hold up?
Well, I mean, I can see where some of these complaints are coming from. And it has to do to some extent with how you conceive of things as being foundational. But something can be foundational in one area, which isn't necessarily foundational just in and of itself. I mean, if we're talking about the political realm and the realm of human interaction, then it seems to me that a really good case can be made that the zero aggression principle is foundational in that order. I mean, I'm at pains to say, and I'm sure you've done this many times yourself, Tom, that the zero aggression principle functions a bit like the way the Ten Commandments function, say, in religion. People say, why are the Ten Commandments mainly negative? And the answer is, well, because they're not telling you primarily what to do. They're telling you that here be dragons, or if you go over here, you're going to fall off a cliff. So they're talking about ways of living and acting that are destructive. But once you understand where the boundaries between destructive action and constructive action lie, then you're free within the area that's mapped out by those negative defensive principles to do whatever you think is best. And so the zero aggression principle might seem purely formal and sort of content-free, but I sometimes say it's a bit like water. I mean, if you think that water is good to drink, it doesn't mean that only water is something that should be drunk. You can drink beer, you can drink wine, you can drink all sorts of things. But without water, none of these would be possible. So the zero aggression principle functions in that way to mark out the boundaries between action that's socially and politically permissible and actions which are not. And within the area of things that are socially, politically permissible, then of course there are many, many things that you can do.
Now, I'm getting us maybe a bit far afield here, but there will be critics, non-libertarian critics, who will say that the non-aggression principle just begs a lot of important questions. So, for example, this issue before us today about redistribution of wealth from people who are better off to people who are worse off, a libertarian views that as a violation of property rights. And by the way, bear in mind that even if you think that in the United States, you would be on the receiving end of such transfers, if we were to extend this principle to the whole world, and of course, in this type of discussion, all we care about is the welfare of mankind, then international boundaries would be irrelevant. So you, as the guy earning $40,000 a year, you're in the global 1%. So now it's your turn to redistribute to everybody else. Then all of a sudden, I bet everybody would object to it. So it usually depends on whose ox is being gored. But anyway, getting back to the complaint, which is a non-libertarian might say, you can't claim to have 100% right to your earnings because your earnings were made possible only by the activities of the state in producing security, courts of law, all the prerequisites. And then, you know, let's say a standard of weight and measures and institutions that keep the market order operational. And so you wouldn't be able to acquire those things and that money without the state's intervention. And so it's not right to say, I own 100% of this. No, we as a society have decided that we need to provide certain services coercively. And so you don't have a right to all that. To some degree, what you earn is kind of the result of everybody in society providing a certain framework within which a market order is possible. So then we'll decide what we think is a sensible percentage of what you quote unquote earn for you to keep. But it's not really exclusively yours, because if it had been only your doing, you probably wouldn't have been able to earn it, because you would have been living in a society where life was solitary, brutish, solitary. What's the Hobbesian formulation? Nasty, brutish, and short?
Short, yes.
Yeah.
Solitary, yeah. I mean, sorry, do you want me to address that? Because that takes us right into the heart of libertarianism, which of course is that, who is the we? We talked about we several times. We decided. Who's we? How do we get to decide this? Okay. I don't remember being asked. Were you asked?
No, I never am. I'm always left out of these things.
Yeah, me too. And here's the thing. Okay, look, people say, oh, well, you wouldn't have this and you wouldn't have that. You wouldn't have roads. Let's take the Hackney Tunnel example. And the answer is, well, I often think in Neanderthal days, some guy standing on the side of the hillside of a valley looking across to the other and thinking, oh my God, I'd love to go over there. If only we had a road. What did he do? Well, he got on his hind legs and he got up and he walked. Look, all of these things will be provided. And of course, no libertarian is suggesting that all of these goods, to the extent that they are goods, roads or water or sanitation and so on, are costless. They have to be paid for. And no libertarian objects to paying for them. I don't. But what I do object to is getting an unitemized bill for services, some of which I have great difficulty in seeing. So let's take the difference. Imagine that food distribution worked in the same way, and that you were levied, I don't know, $10,000 a year for food by the food distribution agency of the state. And they decided what foods you would get, when you would get them, how you would get them, and where you would get them. And you would think, well, I'm not all that keen on that idea. Why don't we have it so that lots of people are in the business of making, distributing food, and I go to them and I make a particular deal with a particular person for the food that I actually want and that he's prepared to sell me. And so the libertarian model for all services is similar to the way in which we deal with food production, distribution, and sales. I am happy to have roads, but I'm happy to pay for them. But what I'm not happy to pay for them several times over and pay for them more than I think they're worth, without having the possibility to engage in considering other services or other providers of roads that might be willing to do so better and at a cheaper cost. So there's so much more to say, but I don't really want to go on that.
Yeah, no. But I still feel like some of these foundational things need to be hit on at least here and there.
Yeah.
All right, so here's the situation. We have right now a social welfare system in every civilized country, let's say. And the concern is that if Jared Casey were to take over and he could abolish everything that violates the zero aggression principle, that would disappear. And so you would have a society exactly like the one we have now, except without a social welfare or without a safety net. And this would have terrible, devastating consequences for many, many vulnerable people. I can understand that there's a superficial plausibility to that claim. And I can understand why somebody would believe it, and why even why a person of genuine goodwill might believe it and be concerned about it. What's a libertarian's response to that, or what's another way of thinking about what's likely to happen?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. Just before I come to it, though, I just want to make the point that I found to my surprise that while I was teaching this, what I thought that the primary objection that people would have to libertarianism would be to its claim that law, justice, and security could be provided by private agencies would be the sticking point. It turned out, in fact, that most people's objection to libertarianism was precisely the idea that without it, there would be a greater number of poor people and all very, very badly off. And so that libertarians were somehow endorsing a vision of society which entailed that you'd have a few very rich people and a lot of very, very poor people and some miserable and dying and so on. So I thought, well, this needs to be addressed. And that's why when I was invited to give a paper to the Queen's University Belfast Libertarian Society, I entitled it, Let the Poor Starve, which was a little bit provocative, I have to say. But the idea was that let's address this question up front. And so the issue is often framed in the form of a dilemma, which is that either you have a safety net of social welfare, which requires the institution of the state with all of its coercive powers, of course, including the powers, we all know, to confiscate and redistribute your property. Or you have a libertarian world with no coercive states or states with coercive activities confined to the provision of law and justice, but also no social welfare and hence no safety net for the poor. And that's a dilemma as it is presented to us. But of course, the dilemma is false. And the way to refute a dilemma is by going between its horns. And the fact is that when you do a little bit of historical research, you discover that there was social welfare long before the state ever got into the welfare business. Forms of non-state social welfare that provided hospital, schools, and unemployment assistance, and much, much more. And this is something which, for many people, has just simply gone down the Orwellian memory hole about which they know nothing. And the key to this are what are called friendly or fraternal societies or mutual aid societies, which have existed for centuries and which provided long before the state ever got into the business. Because remember, for most of its existence, the taxes that the state levied on people were used to fund wars, 90 to 95%. Almost nothing went on anything else. So that people were forced, because of this, if for no other reason, to provide for themselves. And they did. And they've been doing it since about the 17th century. So the modern libertarian would say, well, what we need to do is to reinvigorate and reintroduce things like friendly or fraternal or mutual aid societies. And that's the way it would be in a libertarian polity. I just want to make, before I finish on this point, Tom, I just want to make one thing, which is that critics of libertarianism generally say, what you want is the absolute freedom to do whatever you like with your property, and your society is going to be just like the way we have things today, except without the state and the services it provides. And of course, that's nonsensical. That's not what any, I mean, okay, maybe there are libertarians whose idea of the good life is to go live in the woods and shoot squirrels. But I suspect that most libertarians want to live in society with other people and listen to music and art and make a living and provide services and receive them in return. And this is perfectly capable of being done without the coercive powers of the state. So the libertarian vision of a society is not just what we have today minus the state and what it provides, but a society in which we, the people, everyone, we provide these services for ourselves in ways that are mutually beneficial and enriching, not only financially, but morally, and in terms of producing self-respect and control over our lives.
Hey, folks, let's take a minute to thank our sponsor, Monetary Metals, where our friend Jeff Deist now works. We all know that if you own gold, it can help protect you against inflation. But there's a drawback. It just sits there. It collects dust, or you have to pay storage fees on it. So you start with 100 ounces, maybe you're down to 95 ounces 10 years later. But what if you could actually do something with your gold? What if you could grow your gold, just like you grow other investments? Well, now you can with Monetary Metals, where I've been a client for going on 2 years. Earn 2 to 4% on your gold in their leasing program while supporting qualified gold-using businesses. Accredited investors can earn even higher returns in their gold bonds offerings. All the interest is paid in physical ounces of gold, so your total ounces grow and compound year after year. They've been doing this for 7 years now, and I trust them completely. The great Jeff Deist recently joined forces with them, as I said, and I've had Addison Quayle on the Tom Wood Show. He's their VP of Relationships. I have seen him at every libertarian conference you can possibly imagine. He's been over at my house. He is one of us. The whole team at Monetary Metals sees the world the way you and I do. I'm using them myself to grow my gold. Now you can too. Go to monetary-metals.com/woods to learn more and get started with your account. That's monetary-metals.com/woods. I want to dig a little bit deeper into this. There's a correlation that I can't prove is causal, but that is highly, highly suggestive. And if it were running the other way, well, you can be absolutely certain it would be used against us. And that is, at least in the United States, I can say with no fear of contradiction that the rate of poverty declined much, much more rapidly before the late 1960s, when the real big expansion of the welfare state occurred, both in the kinds of programs and in the amount of money spent on them. Whereas after that happened, we saw the numbers kind of stagnate. Now, if it had been the opposite, if there had been all these social welfare programs and poverty was declining like crazy, and then we took them away and the numbers stagnated, we'd never hear the end of it, right? We'd never hear the end of it.
That's
but
true.
When reality is the way I'm describing, I don't think most people are even realize that. I don't think they even know it. No one tells them because it goes against what the regime wants us to think about the relationship between poverty and allegedly government assistance. So I think there is something about the programs themselves that puts a halt to the kind of progress we were making. I think there is something inherent to the programs. And I think you agree with me. What do you think is wrong with them?
Well, first of all, I think you're right. One of the things that's often missed, and it's an important point, because libertarians, again, we're often accused of focusing only on money and possessions and property and so on. But there's an issue here. Libertarians, I mean, the key is in the name. We're into freedom, and freedom, we want freedom. Freedom is something positive. And one of the things that had happened is that when social welfare programs were introduced, I'm going to take the situation in the UK and Ireland because it's the one I know better, but you can see to what extent it's mirrored in the USA. When the first form of genuine social welfare was introduced in the UK in, or I think it was 1912, of the 12 million people who were covered by those programs, 8 million people were already covered by the friendly societies. And what happened was that this continued for quite a long time, and even up to the end of the Second World War. And after the Second World War, when the welfare state was being brought into existence in the UK, to a much lesser extent here, I should say, the idea was that the friendly societies would be incorporated into some kind of larger structure. But this was rejected by the Labour government at the time. And so you had the phenomenon of crowding out, which is, of course, when people are presented with a good that they can have, quote unquote, for nothing, which isn't really for nothing, but seems to be, and paying for it, even if it's not very much, then of course they'll take what they think is the free. And so, of course, the friendly societies declined and died on the vine. One of the things, however, that's missing is that the friendly societies were mutual aid societies. They were run for, by, and administered by those who were members, for the members. And therefore, they inculcated self-respect, independence, supervisory and administrative capacities were developed by people who had to take control from time to time of what was being done. And when the aid was being issued, to which they were, by the way, they were entitled, it wasn't charity, there was very little milking the system because, unlike the state, which everybody regards as something that they can take whatever they can from without any compunction, the mutual aid societies were your own people, your own workers, your own fellow workers. And therefore, there was the, if you like, a limit to what people would do in terms of cheating the system. So the moral independence and the ability to for people to make decisions and to take control of their own welfare was enhanced by these societies in a way that they're not by the welfare systems. And can I give you some figures? Because I just looked this up the other day just out of curiosity. In Ireland, if you take the major categories of public spending, health, education and welfare account for over 50% of government expenditure. That's a staggering amount. Okay. Something like 52%. Justice and security or law accounts for something like 3.6%. Okay. So if you're worried about having your house burgled, you might well be worried because the state's not prepared to spend a lot of money on that. So a huge amount of money is being transferred. And what tends to happen then is that the recipients begin to feel that they are entitled to this. And so what we've seen here, certainly in Ireland and in the UK, and I'm sure the situation is mirrored in the USA, is that we have people who are in receipt of welfare who have never worked a single day in their life. Okay. And in fact, we're in the second and third generations, whole families and their next generation who have never worked in their lives, who are net, if you like, beneficiaries of the taxation system, which means that somebody else is paying for them. Now, that's an injustice against those whose money, as it were, is being confiscated in order to support them. But it's also detrimental to the self-respect of the recipients who are effectively being told, you are worthless, you are not capable of making a living on your own. You have no skills or abilities that anybody else is willing to pay you for. Here, take some money and go live in a place, preferably far away from those who are being taxed from this, and especially from the people who work in the government and in the administration and in, yeah, and stay out there and please live on the reservation, as it were, and don't come into town. And that's not good. That does nothing to address, if you like, I don't want to sound highfalutin here, but does nothing to address, if you like, the spiritual or the moral dimension of welfare. And by the way, I just want to finish on this one, because again, people misunderstand. They think, what about all of the transfers that occur to the government's buddies in banking and big business. And of course, as libertarians, we are opposed to any form of welfare, corporate welfare, or so-called social welfare. Both of them, if you like, are destructive when it comes right down to it.
I want to read a passage I've read before, but I think it is highly revealing. Now, this is from Charles Murray, who wrote a pretty famous book called Losing Ground back in the 1980s about social welfare policy. Then 10 years later, he updated it in a 10th anniversary edition. But passage I want to read, two passages, runs like this, talking about the 1960s, late 1960s. He says, in the United States, all the changes in the incentives pointed in the same direction. It was easier to get along without a job. It was easier for a man to have a baby without being responsible for it, for a woman to have a baby without having a husband. It was easier to get away with crime. Because it was easier for others to get away with crime, it was easy to obtain drugs. Because it was easier to get away with crime, it was easier to support a drug habit. Because it was easier to get along without a job, it was easier to ignore education. Because it was easier to get along without a job, it was easier to walk away from a job and thereby accumulate a record as an unreliable employee. And then, this is me speaking, the dramatic expansion in welfare spending, along with the aggressive propagation of the welfare rights philosophy, which was spreading at that time, undermined what Murray calls status rewards. So the working poor family, which had once had the dignity of knowing that they were supporting themselves and not being a burden on their usually poor neighbors, now seemed simply foolish. And then the second Murray passage. Once these highly functional sources of status are removed, the vaunted work ethic becomes highly vulnerable. The notion that there is an intrinsic good in working, even if one does not have to, may have impressive philosophical credentials, but on its face, it is not very plausible, at least not to a young person whose values are still being formed. To someone who is not yet persuaded of the satisfactions of making one's own way, there is something laughable about a person who doggedly keeps working at a lousy job for no tangible reason at all. And when working no longer provides either income or status, the last reason for working has truly vanished. The man who keeps working is, in fact, a chump. Well, what do you think?
What can I say? There's nothing in that I could disagree with. It's absolutely correct. And so we have what's known as the poverty or the welfare trap, where, I mean, many people want to be, as it were, on welfare. But what you have then is the welfare system is actually crowding out the rewards of employment at the bottom end of the scale. So that here's the kind of comparison that somebody might make. If I work for 40 hours a week at a not particularly attractive job, I can make, let's say, 50 euros more than I would if I didn't work at all. And so is it worth my while to do that? Because I will lose my benefits and all I will be 50 euros better off with 40 hours of work down. And in a way, there's a kind of rational decision to be made here. And you can see why somebody would say, well, it's not worth my while. It's simply not worth my while. And once you, as you pointed out here from the Murray passage, once you've taken away any status that might be appropriated, as it were, by somebody who actually has a job, then the only difference between being on welfare, being on benefits, and being employed is that 50 euros for the 40 hours that you're working. And people would say, I'm working 40 hours for 50 euros. That's just a euro, 20 cents, or whatever, per hour. And it's not worth my while. And so we have a problem that's probably irremediable under the current way of thinking. It's just really impossible to go back. And of course, the extent and the rewards of so-called welfare and benefits has expanded. The number of people who are on benefits has expanded. The amount that they receive has expanded. The cost to the taxpayer is astronomical. But the problem is that once you introduce any particular benefit of any particular kind, it's almost impossible, politically impossible anyway, from an electoral point of view, to remove it without inviting retribution from those voters who were in receipt of the benefit that you've rescinded.
Here we run into a bit of a problem, and it has to do with something that I've heard some libertarians in the U.S. called no particular orderism. And their argument is, I will take the abolition of any government program in any order. It doesn't have to be in a particular order. I'll take this one and then that one and then that one, all these ones randomly. The trouble with that is, not that I'm inclined to agree, but then I think about this situation where if we were, let's say, to take the quote-unquote social safety net out from under people, but we keep in place all the various things that make employment much more expensive for employers. So not just minimum wage rates, but also various mandated benefits that in some cases can make the employer have to pay an extra 40% for the employee. Mm-hmm. There are various obstacles put in people's places, not just occupational licensure, but I'm sure we could make a list of 100 obstacles that face people that would not be present if the state weren't involved, and it would be much easier for them to find employment and support themselves. But if those stay in place, but the only thing that changes is we're not going to help you out with government money if you have trouble, then I'm not sure about the outcome there or how long lasting, if you could really have a social equilibrium like that.
Yes, I mean, that's a good point. I think you're correct. And that's why when we've talked about these issues in earlier discussions, I pointed out that I'm not a button pusher in terms of bringing in, if you like, the libertarian parousia, that it would be difficult simply to go from one state of affairs to another without it being incredibly destructive in the bad sense of what anarchy means. One way you could do it simply is to take a time-limited program, say 5 to 10 years, and say something like the following. All benefits, except those for which you have contracted, will be eliminated 10 years from now, and they will be reduced by 10% every year, year on year, until they're at zero. And similarly, the burden of costs imposed on employers by the state in respect of things like minimum wage and whatever else they might be, insurance, holidays, and so on, will also be progressively eliminated at the same time. I think if you do it that way, you're still going to have problems and it's still going to be very uncomfortable and there's still going to be a rough ride for quite a few people. But at least you would actually get the job done and people would accommodate themselves to what they know is going to happen for certain. But it's not in the interest of any politician who is now dependent on the electoral system, and I don't care what party they're in, to even begin to suggest anything like this. It's simply not going to happen in our current political systems that we have in the West, which are now hugely dependent on welfare. And of course, coming down the track, okay, we have the king of all these things, which is the universal basic income, which at least drops the pretense that the social welfare programs are meant to be stopgaps and recognizes the fact that they are indeed permanent sources of wealth transfer from the working population to the non-working population. That's about all that can be said in their favor, though, is that they, if you like, admit for the first time that this is what has actually happened. Yes, I don't know. I wish I had a solution, Tom. I don't, but all I can say is some time-directed way. If you don't like 10 years, take 20 years if you think it's going to take that long. But you've got to bring it in over a number of years and stick to it. But of course, you know what will happen. Is that halfway through or some years into any program like this, a new government would be elected and could simply change the policy. So I can't see that happening.
Well, I think the approach Ron Paul took was smart politics, but also just smart social policy, in which he said, let's start with the low-hanging fruit from our point of view. The most obviously unworthy people from our point of view would be the military-industrial complex, various companies sucking on the proverbial teat. We begin with that.
Yes.
We begin with dismantling the American empire. I mean, Ireland doesn't really have this issue where it can just pull from these huge expenditures because it doesn't have them anywhere near what the U.S. does. But we do, and we can draw from that, and we can pull some revenue for that first. So again, I more or less believe in no particular orderism, but there are just some aspects of universal justice that make me hesitate to say that the initial burden of overturning state programs should fall on the poorest rather than the most guilty parties of all, the merchants of death, just to start with. And then we could go on down and find many classes of other unworthy people, entire federal agencies. Inevitably, we do have to pull back on the social welfare spending, if for no other reason than that the trajectory of it is such that it will eventually just consume the entire budget, more or less. I mean, they will come pretty close or consume just an impossibly large percentage of it. So at some point, it has to be done. It's not a matter of we're not nice people. It's a matter of reality. No. We only have so many resources. But I liked Ron Paul's thing where he said, I would have a transition and I would begin by scaling back all these things. And the things he can scale back as president are actually fairly substantial. A lot of people would say if Ron Paul got elected, there's not much he could do. But he can, as commander-in-chief, bring all those troops home. And that's a big, big start. He can just do that on his own. So we have this extra source of wealth to draw on that's being siphoned off that we could just put a stop to that a lot of other countries don't have, basically.
I actually don't disagree with you at all. Of course, the situation in the U.S. is singular in that respect, in that the U.S. has either taken on or had thrust upon it the role of the kind of the world's police. And if I were a taxpayer in Kansas, I would be wondering why it is that some of my taxes is going to pay for setting up bases in places I've never even heard of for reasons I don't particularly understand why it is that this is supposed to be of some concern to me. But to take the larger point, I mean, I agree with you. So I didn't say this because I thought it was actually obvious, but clearly the first things that should go are government expenditures or government revenues being used to engage in activities that should be done privately. So firms, for example, are receiving subsidies, corporate subsidies, corporate welfare, all of those things should disappear. And to the extent that there are things in our societies that mirror the U.S. industrial military complex, those too should be scaled back. But of course, absolutely, those should be the first things hit. So I don't have any disagreement on that.
Hey, everybody, a quick message from our friends at CrowdHealth. If there's one thing everybody can agree on, it's that the American healthcare system is completely screwed up. Nobody's happy with it. It's full of red tape. It's crazy expensive. Nothing makes any sense. And it leaves you feeling completely helpless. But CrowdHealth is doing something about it. It's not health insurance. It's a better way to pay for healthcare through crowdfunding. We've all heard or experienced the horror stories involving confusing health insurance processes you feel taken advantage of. CrowdHealth is doing things differently. Your $50 a month membership includes the tools and services you need to get the highest quality healthcare. You'll get access to telemedicine visits, discounted prescriptions, and so much more without doctors' networks messing things up. You'll have access to your own personal care advocate who will help navigate you through the complexities of American healthcare, negotiate bills on your behalf, and of course, you'll be part of the crowd, which is a bunch of sensible people like you who want to secede from the current system and be part of something in which people come together to help pay for each other's unexpected health events. It's time you opt out of restrictive health insurance plans and let CrowdHealth help fit your healthcare needs. Get started today for just $50 per month. Go to joincrowdhealth.com/woods to get the healthcare you deserve. CrowdHealth is not insurance. Learn more at joincrowdhealth.com/woods. That's joincrowdhealth.com/woods. Well, another thing Charles Murray said, this was in a different book called In Pursuit of Happiness and Good Government. He said, first of all, if you look at charts depicting charitable giving goes way down in the late 60s. Well, why? I mean, people were doing reasonably well. Why does it go down? Well, the message is we're going to take care of this now. So of course it would go down. But wouldn't that just be common sense? Mm-hmm. Whereas in the 1980s, even though strictly speaking, all that happened in the federal government was that the rate of growth was slowed, the impression people got was we're cutting back. And then charitable giving went considerably upward again. All throughout the alleged decade of greed, the 1980s, nobody even bothers to point out how substantially charitable giving grew during that supposedly greedy decade. Well, I think there's an interesting thought experiment that Murray follows up with that. And he says, well, think about right now, think of talents you have. You know, you're a lawyer, you could be giving pro bono consults here and there, like every Friday afternoon, or if you're a good teacher, you could be teaching literacy to some people, or just think of all the talents you have and how you could put them to the service of people who need them. And now ask yourself, am I doing this? And the answer, of course, is no. But if next week, all of a sudden, you realize that society had changed dramatically in terms of how resources are deployed, and now there are a lot of people who need services that just aren't going to be given to them, is there any chance you might help out? Of course you would. Mm-hmm. So that proves that right away, your own self-examination proves what the incentives of these things are, is to have civil society withdraw from what it would normally be doing, which is help people who genuinely want to help themselves and who just need this or that. We do that for them. But now if the impression is, well, you hand us the money and we'll make sure it happens, then we don't do it.
Yeah, no, I agree again with you on this one, Tom. in the Charles Dickens book, The Christmas Carol, when Scrooge is walking along the street and he's asked for money for some charity, he says, "Have we not workhouses?" And his point is that there was what they call the poor rate in the UK, which is a taxation, a levy on people to provide for a very rudimentary and, by the way, quite savage system of support. Nothing to write home about, certainly nothing to compare with what we have today. But his point was, I've already had this money taken from me. Okay, so why should I give to charity? Now, the astonishing thing is, as you and I both know, is that despite the savage rates of taxation that almost everybody working in the West experiences, the number of charities that operate on donations is staggering. Okay, so you have to ask yourself, if in a situation where people are able to retain much more of their income, what would they do? Well, I know some people would probably go on several holidays a year or build a swimming pool. But many people, especially those people who are already giving significant amounts of their money to charity, would give even more. So, I mean, let's put the question like this. Suppose we were able to reintroduce friendly society into our societies. Would the world then be perfect? And the answer is no, because perfection is impossible. But like anything else, the decision is between scheme A and B is not which is perfect, because neither is perfect, but which, taking everything into account, is the better. And there's no reason to think that a libertarian world with flourishing friendly societies would be less effective at relieving want than what we have at present. And in fact, there's every reason to think it would be more effective while, and this is really, really important, while at the same time respecting people's freedom, their property, their decisions, and their responsibilities. And as I said, in the libertarian world, charity would be even more effective in reaching people in need than it is now. Because first of all, there would be far fewer poor people, many more people with more disposable incomes, and therefore a greater amount of money available for a much smaller target. So the question then you have to ask yourself, like the Clint Eastwood mode, is do you feel lucky punk? No, I don't mean that. It's who holds the high moral ground in this issue? The state welfarists or libertarians? And I don't have to think very long before answering that question.
Last time I had you on, or you know what? I can't remember if it was last time I had you on the show or if it was when you were doing the Q&A on Liberty Classroom, but I wanted to ask you if people wanted to follow you and read what you have to say, where should they do it? And you gave Twitter as an example, but you have this crazy long Twitter handle. So I'll just recommend that if people would like to follow Professor Casey, I'll have his Twitter handle up at tomwoods.com/2353, the show notes page for today. But if you'd like to try to give it out to the audience, I am absolutely game for that.
Okay. So for those of you who are listening carefully, pencils at the ready, my Twitter handle is at Casey, C-A-S-E-Y, 5122-D-A-R-K. It's not that long. Casey 5122 dark.
All right. So maybe I'm exaggerating the problems associated with this. But anyway, if you did not have a pencil at the ready, try to keep in your brain just the number 2353. That's the episode number. So tomwoods.com/2353. I'll have several of Professor Casey's books linked there as well that you can check out. And I'm hopeful. How many books is this for you in your career, by the way?
I can't remember. It's at least 7 and could be 8. I can't quite remember.
I love an author who doesn't even know how many books he has. Okay, well, very good, very good. If it ever becomes N+1 because of whatever this project is, we'll definitely have to talk about that. But I certainly appreciate your time coming on and talking about your paper and about this important topic. So thanks so much.
Thank you very much, Tom.
All right, folks, before we go, I have a funny feeling I have some gun owners in the audience. I'm going to go with that. I think I've probably got some gun owners in the audience. So picture this. It's a worst case scenario. You've needed to use your weapon to defend your life. You're out of ammo, but you're still in danger. So your life depends on getting more bullets into that gun. Nobody who's been in a firefight has ever said, I wish I had less ammo than I have now. So maybe you aren't even carrying a spare magazine. Your current spare mag carry system may be bulky and uncomfortable. You may have a spare magazine in a backpack or a purse or a pocket, but it's going to take precious time to find it, and it's probably full of lint and debris. Bullets may even have been knocked out of it. Maybe you're carrying a spare magazine inside your waistband, but as you confidently draw it, the belt clip fails and the whole magazine carrier comes off your belt. You're left with an empty gun in one hand and a magazine that's trapped in its carrier in the other hand. In any of these situations, Your Spear magazine carry system has cost you your life. The Mag Clam by TickMade is sleek and comfortable, created by a Tom Woods Show listener, moves with your body, making it more comfortable and concealable, protects and secures a magazine virtually anywhere, and secures the magazine facing either direction. On belts, in cars, purses, backpacks, on a wall, under a desk, a chair leg, etc. Most importantly, when you draw the magazine, the Mag Clam always stays secured to its mounting point. The magazine comes free and can be loaded into the gun every time. Check out the Mag Clam at tickmade.com. That's TickMade.com. And take 15% off with promo code Woods. He also has an affiliate program that pays 25% commission. So if you know other gun owners who might benefit from this, you earn 25% on every sale. But take 15% off your own order with coupon code Woods. The website, once again, is tickmade.com, TickMade.com. And remember, if you're thinking of starting a website, well, before you start that site, check out tomwoods.com/publicity to find out how I can help you with free publicity like this and other great bonuses. So that page, once again, on my website is tomwoods.com/publicity. See you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.